Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Streets Ahead is a popular podcast hosted by Adam Tranter, Ned Bolting, and Laura Laker. And we're incredibly excited to actually have one of those episodes being recorded live here for the London Walking and Cycling Conference. I am going to welcome one third of the Streets Ahead podcast team and her very special guest for this episode. So please give it up.
Hi, and welcome to Streets Ahead. Can you hear me? Your podcast dedicated to cycling, walking, and wheeling in the UK and beyond. Usually Ned does that bit, but we don't have Ned here, sadly. I'm Laura Laker. Adam Tranter, sadly, is also unwell, so couldn't make it. But instead, we have tens of people in front of me and my guests because we are live, recording live, at the London Walking and Cycling Conference in the City of London's Guildhall, which is a beautiful building, and it's a sunny day, so thank you all for being here and joining us for the podcast. So it's great. Usually we're in a kind of basement somewhere near London Bridge and there's no light, so this is great. So the London Walking and Cycling Conference, for listeners who don't know, is an annual get-together where London basically gets to be smug and show off about what it's doing and share great practice. And it's wonderful to be here because we get to see wonderful people doing great stuff to try and make the world a slightly better place. It started life with the Hackney Walking and Cycling Conference in 2017, and it has gone from strength to strength, had visitors from all over the world, speakers. And this year's theme is taking walking and cycling to the next level, the path to climate neutrality. So we all know active travel has a huge role to play in cutting carbon emissions for shorter trips, as well as part of longer journeys involving public transport. We have some great guests today, three of them. We have Councillor Mette Choban, who is in charge of energy, waste, transport and the environment for Hackney Council, which means you get emails about dog poo, bins and parking, basically the trifecta for local councillors, so it must be a great time for you. And we have Liz Clements from Birmingham, and you are the Cabinet Member for Transport. Welcome. And on my left we have Phil Jones, who is Technical Advisor to the Walking and Cycling Commissioner for the West Midlands, aka our own Adam Tranter. Who couldn't be here? So we thought we would talk today about, because we're in London, because we have people who work in different parts of the country, what can the rest of the country learn from London? Because there has been some great progress here. There's been great progress elsewhere in the country, but London seems to be nailing it at the moment. According to Transport for London, active travel is up on 40% on pre-pandemic levels against 11% across the rest of the country. Obviously, cities are going to have bigger increases, rural areas perhaps less, but that's the sort of broad picture. So maybe we'll start with Mette. What do you think London is kind of getting right, and I guess your corner of London, Hackney?
Yeah, firstly, it's great to be on the podcast.
Yeah, great
thanks,
to have you.
Thanks for having us, and it's great that you're doing it as part of the conference. I think, look, like, I think everywhere is different. And I'd always caveat that because Hackney is very unique from the rest of London, which is very unique from the rest of the country. And I say that because, I didn't say this in the opening remarks, but if you look at a context of Hackney, we've got very low ownership levels of cars, so for households. So 30% of households have cars. More than 87% of people either walk, cycle, or take public transport. 40% of traffic neither start or end in Hackney. And partly that's because we're quite an inner London borough. So the way in which we're geographically located, so we're in the city now, we're surrounded by the city, by East London, by North London, and everyone's driving through Hackney to get to where they need to. And obviously for us, you know, we want people to come and shop there locally and visit their family, friends, but there's got to be that balance between good air quality and obviously, and also find an equitable balance for, you know, making sure your the roads are for everyone. So what I would say, what other regions can learn from Hackney, as opposed to specific schemes, because as I say, schemes work different everywhere, is more of the ambition that we have for cleaning our air and being very progressive. I always say, you know, whenever we've made the moves to make very bold moves with some of our schemes, I've always sort of, you know, when I have this chat with the mayor and other councillors as well, we have this chat with officers, I always say, you know, like, it's not just about Hackney, it's about the message it sends to the rest of London and the rest of the country and the confidence it gives to our borough and neighbourhoods to take forward. And, you know, recently we had, you know, motorcycles, for example, never paid for parking in the borough, never ever paid for it, and they just felt like it should be for free. So cycling should have to pay for cycle parking, but then they should have it for free. And, you know, they fought us really hard when I tried to introduce...
anything with parking, yeah, as you'll well know, is very difficult.
But it's because they knew that if Hackney done it, other boroughs will start to follow. So they fought us really hard on it. So I think what other regions can learn from us, and again, as I say, like, I work very closely with Liz, for example, and other my counterparts as well, but it's the political ambition that we share across the capital and the country.
Yeah. And your predecessor was John Burke, who was who's famously outspoken, very kind of bullish with his approach to the LTNs during the pandemic. There were, what, 19, 20 low-traffic neighbourhoods during the pandemic, and there's now 48 school streets.
What I would say is low-traffic neighbourhoods in Hackney go back to the 1970s. So the Beauvoir and also sort of the Brownswood area, we've got low traffic neighbourhoods too historically. And the one in the Beauvoir that we had, the one in the 1970s, was because we had parents who was out there arguing for the safety of their children. And there's some really great photos from in the archives where you could see, you know, parents going out on the road, blocking the roads with kids. So this, our story goes back to the 70s, but of course, you know, my predecessor John Burke, but also Ferial Clark, you know, Ferial Clark, who's now an MP for Enfield North, she's played a huge role in making sure, you know, I remember when she first brought in a small filter into London Fields, 600 people turned up to a meeting, absolutely angry about it, and it's like,
I remember that meeting, yeah. I think it was known afterwards as a pitchfork meeting, or yeah, something. There was a lot of anger.
So, you know, hats off to them and everyone else, is obviously who's got us to where we are. Mm.
Yeah, and Liz, in Birmingham, you've got some great, quite exciting plans, actually, for Birmingham. There's the famous kind of Ghent-style circulation plan, so trying to prevent through traffic through the city. There's plans for main road cycle lanes, there's plans for contraflow cycle lanes. But maybe it might be nice for listeners to sort of talk about your kind of journey to where you are, like what kind of got you interested in this, and like what kind of Birmingham's achieving.
Yes, well, perhaps I can start with answering the question about what is it, you know, that we can learn from London, and what's motivated me to come here today. And it's mainly because Adam Tranter, who isn't here, prodded me to come. So he's very much an absent friend, very much missed on this panel. But that's where the motivation came from. And it's not a question of the conditional, what could or would we learn from London. I am learning, because I am being mentored by Meta through the Local Government Association. And I actively asked for Meta, because I could see that Hackney was a real beacon of best practice. Also Islington, obviously Waltham Forest. So in Birmingham, you know, we're a big city, the regional capital. We want to go out and learn. We held our own transport summit in April in Birmingham with a range of speakers, including Clyde Lokes from Waltham Nottingham Forest, Pascal Smet from Brussels, you know, who, where we're looking at an example of really de-trafficking, you know, horrendously congested city centre, which is the task that we've got in Birmingham.
Because it's a very car-centric city.
Yeah. So we're in Birmingham, we're on a journey towards a low-traffic future. So everything that I've heard today is absolutely inspirational. I've read your book, Movement, Mark, and it was just so just really inspirational to hear you. And all of the projects that I've heard presented are really, really inspiring. But I think probably the most powerful thing for me is some of the statistics. For example, the statistics about the accident reduction in low traffic neighbourhood areas, the accident reductions associated with 20 mile an hour speed limit zones. And I think, you know, that's the evidence that we need in Birmingham to push forward with this agenda. We've got a very, very ambitious strategic plan, the Birmingham Transport Plan. And that is, you know, all about reallocating road space, taking out through journeys in the city centre. That's what you were referring to, Laura, with the Ghent style approach. Low traffic neighbourhoods in all of our suburbs, and, you know, parking demand management. So really looking at what is the actual level of demand for parking and how can we reduce it. So all of that is, you know, a really ambitious agenda. We launched that strategy in 2021. We've just launched the delivery plan at the summit that I just referred to. And we are, obviously, we're Birmingham. We were the centre of car manufacturing. We are Motor City. In effect, people would think of us as, you know, being the UK's Detroit, but we're reinventing ourselves. We're constantly reinventing ourselves in Birmingham, and our aim now is for a livable, walkable, cyclable city everywhere in every neighbourhood. But I think one of the things, though, but, you know, before I get carried away in the enthusiasm, is actually to set some context, because when I come to these events, what I'm very, very aware of is that the conditions are different. So in Birmingham, our public transport network is not as integrated or as extensive as what is available in Greater London. So our mass transit network is buses. We have some local train lines. We have a metro line that we're extending. So for me, you know, one of the things, you know, I'll take away messages about boldness in terms of advocating for active travel and walking and cycling, but also going to the government and actually asking for the resources to implement this agenda. Because I have spent this week in meetings arguing about, you know, likely cuts to bus services and local rail services, and really that undermines the whole, you know, the whole drive to get people out of their cars. And in Birmingham, you know, we're quite a spread out city, so the distances that people are walking or cycling are sometimes quite long, and you might want to combine your journey with public transport and take your bike, as Laura said. And it's all of those options. I want to give people as many choices as they can so that their life is as easy as possible when they decide to leave their car at home. And so I find it inspiring, but this is spurring me on to ask for the resources needed to make that change.
And you have Andy Street, the West Midlands mayor, who's very keen on this. And I remember writing an article years ago about lack of progress in the West Midlands, and since then it couldn't have changed more. They've got Adam on board, they've got a lot more funding, and there's the Starley network, which is the big plan for the network of routes across the region. So yeah, things have changed a lot. And over to Phil. So Phil, technical advisor, you've been in this industry for a long time.
Yeah.
You've worked on a lot of projects, firstly with developers,
yes,
advising developers
yes.
on yeah, walking and cycling integration.
No, we're advising developers how to get planning consent for new
okay.
housing estates.
Okay. So yeah, so now you're working with Adam, and you're working with Lee Waters in Wales
on
the 20 miles an hour plan.
Yes.
And so you're working in around the country, basically. What do you think other places in the UK can learn from London?
Well, I mean, I think what's really interesting is that London has changed things technically. I mean, I began to work particularly in cycling around perhaps 2009, 2010. I was lucky enough, I see John Dales is here, and we have this fantastic gig. It was the best job we ever had, I think, in 2012, where TfL paid us to go around the world and study
13
cycling.
Mark Strong saying.
Yeah, and Mark would be like the odd couple in New York, cycling around New York and learning stuff. So, and we came back and we gave those lessons to TfL, who then produced, or Brian Deegan produced, the London Cycling Design Standards. And I think that was absolutely groundbreaking. So I think some of the things that London was doing, actually pushing the envelope with the, we tend to look in this country, we're a very centralised state, aren't we? Local authorities tend to look to central government for leadership. When it comes to particularly cycling infrastructure, that just hasn't happened. And what you found, particularly with TfL, is they took on the mantle and they put the money into the research. I remember all of those off-road trials of low-level traffic signals that we now take for granted that were quite groundbreaking around sort of 2012, 2013. So London has really led the way, and then that expertise, the job that we've now got, those of us who work outside London, is to spread that expertise, to spread that knowledge. Because what I'm finding, and I know this, you know, around the country, is there are differences in terms of the technical capabilities of within local authorities, within the consultant supply chain, about what good looks like. And we've still got a lot of lessons to learn. You know, isn't it what they say, that the future's here, it's just not everywhere. So some of the future is in London, and we need to spread that around the rest of the country. But what I just want to kind of say, though, is it's, you know, technical is not enough. I think what we also have in London, and we're beginning to get in other places, you know, Liz in Birmingham, is that political leadership, because there's no point having the resources and the technical knowledge about how to design this stuff if the politicians, the decision makers, don't make that decision or can't feel that they can't make that decision because of perhaps public concerns to take those few parking spaces away to the benefit of everyone else. You know, so I think what London can show to us is that consistent political leadership and the technical excellence that we need to spread around the country.
Yeah, and it seems to be that the mayoral regions are the ones that are pushing the kind of envelope, pushing things forward. They're the ones with the political leadership often, and it seems like most metro mayors in the UK are behind this agenda. They see the benefits, they want their region to thrive, and they understand that having a healthy cycling and walking environment, having a good public realm attracts business, attracts people. And also, you know, on the theme of today's conference, there's an urgency. I mean, by law, the UK needs to cut its emissions by 2050. Transport is 27% of our emissions. It's remained stubbornly high. Electric vehicles aren't going to get us there. And we kind of know the technical solutions. We know that where we need to go, and we kind of know it's popular, but then there's that sort of disjointed piece between like what where we know we need to be and where and how to get there. And I think Hackney is I remember that meeting, I think it was the same meeting about the London feels, and I think that was the kind of precursor to the kind of LTN anger, because I was covering it at the time as a journalist, and it was amazing. I mean, I hadn't seen it before, and I think this has been repeated around the country, but I wonder you know, Hackney's kind of, I guess this is still a problem, but you've kind of gone through this already, and I wonder, I know you've been in the job a couple of years now in this post, but I wonder what insight you might have.
I mean, look, I get more people angry at me now for not doing more in Hackney. Not genuinely, seriously. And like, you know, then it sort of translates to the officers, and I go to them and say to Tyler, I'm like, Tyler, we need to talk, where's our school streets and LTNs? No, I'm joking. But like, when I first came into my role, I mean, I think it would be disingenuous to say that everything was like great and amazing. You know, certainly there was a lot of anger and a lot of relationships that we had to fix. And I think one of the things that we've learned in Hackney is, you know, I think, you know, we have to be honest, and we've learned lots of new ways of engaging with people. And that's been part of my role. It's about how do you take people on a journey with you. And that was kind of what I was trying to allude to at the start when I was talking about the aspiration point, and particularly for some working class families. But even on the whole topic of climate change, right, I always find, and not just with transport as well, when you go out there and you say you want to, like, you're doing all of this because you're trying to save the planet, obviously that's important, otherwise none of us would be here if we didn't have a planet. But actually what you've got to do is you've got to make it relatable to people's day-to-day lives, right? So the people who, you know, like, that I know from my backgrounds and similar backgrounds are more likely to suffer. I used to have asthma when I was a kid. They're more likely to suffer from bad air quality. They're more likely to pay more money on their energy bills. They're more likely to live in a neighborhood where they don't have the, you know, like if you lived in a tower block during the pandemic, where were you out getting your fresh air and stuff when we was in lockdown, for example? So the bit that I'm really trying to focus on in relation to transport specifically, it's about that social justice element and that equitable element for people who live in the borough. And that's why we're really investing a lot into the public realm, not just in terms of like reducing car usage, but it's actually about how you invest into, like, we planted 5,000 street trees since 2018, like phenomenal number of like street trees. And that's like really made a difference to the way visually things look. And also people feel like, you know, you're investing into where they live. So, you know, I don't see that same level of anger as much as when I first came in. And I do agree with Will, actually, that there is a very loud minority of people who sound like it makes it sound loud. There are also obviously people that have genuine concerns. Again, like I remember when I first came into my role, I remember we didn't have blue badge exemption for LTNs, and I just thought that was the most bonkers thing ever. Like, why wouldn't you have blue badge exemption? You know, like, clearly there's a need for it. And those are the things that you've got to be honest and open about. And, you know, and to be fair to the officers, they came up with a really good solution, which now put that whole argument to bed, and no one ever raises it no more.
So what was the solution?
Well, we now have an exemption for blue badge, all Hackney blue badge holders on our bus gates. So there's four specific bus gates: Church Street, Shepherd's Walk, Downs Road, and the fourth one, and Richmond Road, where you're able to drive through if you're a blue badge holder. But now, by addressing all of those different things, it's brought us into a completely new arena now, where actually, as I say, like, we don't really get many complaints about it no more. And, you know, like, even when people say you're going to lose votes, and I'm not trying to sound, you know, it's not all about me, right? But I brought in the scheme in my own ward in Stoke Newington 7 or 8 months before the election, and then I got the highest vote that I had in comparison to the previous two elections. And everyone was saying to me, you're going to lose the election because you brought in your own specific ward. And my vote jumped up by about 15-20% in comparison to the previous election. So clearly it's not a vote loser.
Yeah. It's quite a common story, actually, that we hear from around the world. There's there's kind of loud opposition, but then actually it seems like most people support it. So Church Street, how did you do that? Because that was kind of a scary one, and there were concerns. And I know that access for people with disabilities who use a car, that's kind of a fear that people have, that they won't be able to.
Yeah, I mean, look, Church Street was interesting because, as I say again, it wasn't us who came up with the scheme and went to the people. It was, going back to what I was saying at the start of the day, it was us responding to campaigns from the people in the area. From
and we
the
probably
schools.
Should describe actually what Church Street is for people who don't know it.
So Church Street is basically, it's a through road, B road, typically had about 10 to 12,000 cars driving through it a day. In the Mayor of London's, I think it was a 2017 report around pollution levels around schools, had William Patton School at one of the highest levels of pollution in the capital city. And it's, you know, got loads of businesses there, for those who are listening to the podcast. So it's a very, like, you know, traditional London street, which is a through road, loads of cars. It's a very narrow road, so it's not like a big road. So when you drive, you know, like, the pavements were very narrow. So what we done on Church Street was we bought a low traffic neighbourhood scheme, which basically comprised of five filters, like the traditional ones that you have with the planters, and those are 24-hour filters. And we also had a bus gate on Church Street itself, which cuts the sort of the daytime through traffic between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And that was sort of the compromise that we felt that was required to be able to cut the daytime traffic. And then you have a blue badge exemption. You have exemption for Hatzola for emergency services, and also for council refuse trucks as well. But what we also done on Church Street was, it wasn't just, oh, let's just cut traffic. It was massively invested in the public realm. So we widened the pavements on Church Street. We put 6 community parklets there where people, you know, like the work that Brenda is doing in Hackney, you know, and
big
has been
up to Brenda and her parklets, the founder of the parklets in London, Hackney.
We did that. We put electric vehicle charging points, more street trees. So it just looks and feels so much more different now. And, you know, as a result, footfall's gone up by, I think it's about 16 or 18%. Cycling's gone up by 36%. I said Visa, MasterCard transactions have gone up about 200%. And guess what? People on foot bring you more customers. Which obviously lots of people disputed before, but those are the sorts of things that have massively helped bring about change on Church Street.
Yeah, and obviously, Liz, as we know, Hackney started this journey a long time ago. Birmingham's more recently on this journey. Where is kind of Birmingham at on this journey at the moment, would you say?
I wouldn't entirely agree with that, because we started a process called the Birmingham Cycle Revolution in 2012, 2013.
Okay, fair point.
So, obviously, you know, we've got, you know, two major segregated cycleways on the A34 and the A38 in Birmingham. Those, you know, were, you know, quite long in the inception, but the work on those started in 2012 and 2013. And a lot of that came from campaign groups, you know, from the ground up, and people challenging us on, you know, just how dangerous it was to cycle in Birmingham. And I think I should give credit to those campaigners, because we've got a lot of cycle infrastructure already. when Chris Boardman came to Birmingham in the autumn, we took him on the A38 cycle route. We took him past Edgbaston Cricket Ground, up towards Moseley on the new infrastructure that we built for the Commonwealth Games. Again, in the run-up to the Commonwealth Games, we massively extended the A38 Blue route. So we're getting there, but you know, the scale of what we're doing in Birmingham is massive. You know, we're a single authority covering a 1.3 million city. So I was interested in your comments on leadership in the mayoral combined authorities, because obviously different political dynamic in the West Midlands. We've got a Conservative mayor, Andy Street, and a combination of Labour and Conservative authorities. And I really admire Andy because I believe that he actually role models the behaviour. He does use public transport, he does walk and cycle, and I think it would be great if some of that behaviour is emulated by some of the Conservative leaders of the authorities that are within the West Midlands CA. Because I think when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, for example, of, you know, when Birmingham was introducing our clean air zone, Andy was able to give a high-level commitment to it, but I think the reception amongst other, for example, local Conservative councillors in Birmingham was not so warm, let alone in some of the other councils in the CA area. I don't want to stray too much into parochial and very party politics, but I think you need to appreciate the dynamics and the fact that other parts of the country, you know, want to share your ambition and are inspired by your boldness, yeah. but the context is different. So in Birmingham, you know, we're trying to build, you know, the sort of network of cycle routes that you'll see in the Netherlands. So in the autumn, I went with Sustrans, I went to Rotterdam and Delft, and that, since I've been in this portfolio, which is now sort of about a year and a half, that's the most inspiring thing that I've done, because it was those places are places where I saw middle-aged women like me in normal clothes, mums and dads, kids on bikes, without cycle helmets, cycling everywhere, and it was just a joy to be there. And obviously for me, you know, I was really fascinated by Rotterdam because that's, you know, a really good direct comparator to Birmingham, and I'd love us to be with that level of infrastructure and that level of public transport provision. So I think we've got to keep going. We've got, you know, the same debates in Birmingham about low traffic neighbourhoods, but we're pushing ahead with that. You know, we've got a big low traffic neighbourhood in King's Heath and Moseley, you know, which is, we've just agreed to extend. I've just launched a consultation on a low traffic neighbourhood places for people scheme in Bourneville and Cotteridge, which is the ward that I represent. We'll soon be going into delivering one in Lascelles, north of the city centre, and I've actually got residents coming to me now and asking whether they can have a low traffic neighbourhood in their area. And if you look at new housing estates, so if any of you know South Birmingham, there's been a major redevelopment on the site of the old Selly Oak Hospital, and there are two massive residential estates there, and they are in effect giant low traffic neighbourhoods, because that's how people want to live. If you've got small children, vulnerable older people, or if you just generally want to have a good quality of life, you do not want to live somewhere that's blighted by traffic. And I think we need to come back to those arguments about quality of life and livability, and that's the real reason. And you know, the reason why we're all councillors, which is sometimes a thankless job, is that we're trying to make a positive difference, make change for the better. And I think that's the way we need to pitch it.
Yeah, and we were speaking earlier, you said that you'd lived in Germany and you'd seen sort of cities like Birmingham in Germany, and they'd kind of delivered kind of cycle routes, and I don't know, you also referenced Rotterdam. How long do you think it would take for Birmingham to be like Rotterdam with a cycle network? What would you like to see?
I think it'll take quite a while. I wasn't saying that I'd found a city exactly like Birmingham in Germany. What I was saying is that I've lived in a number of conurbations in Germany, and you know, that's what sort of inspired me to be interested as a layperson in transport.
You saw people cycling.
I was a postgraduate student in Hamburg in the early 1990s, and there, you know, I lived in the city centre. It was possible to live with unproblematically without a car. There was excellent public transport, and you could take your bike, on public transport for longer trips. And I still feel that many places in England outside London are still sort of really decades away from that. But we need to aspire for better things, though. So that's why we need to actually start having serious conversations with government about what levelling up really means.
And Phil, you wanted to come in about LTNs?
Yeah, I was just going to say, the whole question of LTNs, I think it's become a term
that it's
become an unhelpful term. It's a bit like shared space, that we all thought that was a great thing, or some of us thought it was a good thing. And then it becomes something that actually it's hard to define, really. The problem with a low-traffic neighbourhood, what is it? The term was only coined, I think, about, what, 6 or 7 years ago? When Waltham Forest first did its what became low-traffic neighbourhoods, I remember John Little, who was very much the brains behind that, talked about villagisation. You know, that was the term that he used. These kind of Victorian grids were going to be turned from just a kind of amorphous mass of housing into something of a community by removing the through traffic. And that was fantastic. But what we know is that those people who lose through any intervention shout much louder than those people who gain. And I think it's great that in Hackney you've got that, and in other parts of London you've got those evidence, and increasingly in Birmingham with King's Heath and so on, you can point to success. But in other parts of the country, it's quite difficult to do that. And I think the furore that we've seen in some parts of the press around this term and this kind of demonisation of the term low traffic neighbourhood, it's having quite a corrosive effect, and it's having those politicians who are perhaps more nervous about the idea of any kind of car restraint are feeling they're becoming demotivated to put themselves into that confrontational position, because you hear Clyde, I'm sure, you know, Mette and others and Liz, it's not a comfortable place to be when you're having those kind of brickbats thrown at you. So I think one of the things that we as professionals in this have to get smarter at is how do we make sure that the silent majority is no longer silent. How do we make sure that the loud anti-voices, who we know are about only a third of the population, are not the ones that the politicians lead to, they're not the ones that the media amplify their voices, and we somehow give voice to this silent majority. I'm doing, as Laura mentioned, I've been doing a lot of work with Lee Waters in Wales. I chaired the task force that helped to bring in the default 20 mile an hour speed limit. And when we did that task force report, one of the things that was recommended, we recognised that was going to be a huge change, and there should be some very early engagement with the people of Wales to make sure that it could be demonstrated that there was support out there, and we reflected that support back to the population of Wales. Unfortunately, due to electoral cycles and timing and budgets, that hasn't quite happened. And I think he referred to it when he spoke, that the road towards a default 20 has been a little rockier than it might have been if we'd sort of rolled the pitch, if you like, to use a kind of cricketing metaphor. And I think, you know, we have to get a bit smarter about that, of getting our information in first before the antis can kind of contaminate the ground. You know, some people talk about immunisation. In a kind of medical sense, we immunise the population against misinformation by giving them the truth before that. Because if you come along with stats and stuff, but they've already made their mind up, then you're probably going to find it very difficult. I don't know if you would agree, you know. But I think once you've kind of seeded the ground to the very vociferous minority, then it's going to be quite hard to move back.
I've heard it called pre-bunking as well. I've heard it in relation to sort of vaccinations. Yeah. Obviously during the pandemic there was a lot. It's sort of debunking, but it's getting in before with kind of information. So there was someone on a podcast talking about how it's about kind of giving people information so they're kind of armed, so that when discussions do happen, that they can kind of, it's easier to kind of sift for the fact from fiction. So it would be nice to have questions at some point soon. And I guess we've got 20 minutes until the official end of the thing. So we might just do a couple more questions and then be prepared to wield a mic and think of some questions, because we'd love to hear from you. But
It's something very, just which I forgot to mention, right? Because obviously in the context of this conference, because it's got our logo, there's a lot of talk about Hackney. But actually, like, one of my colleagues, Michael Carter, was here, legend from Haringey, who's my counterpart. Then you've got James Asser from Newham Borough, and John, who's here as well. You had Joe Blackman from Redbridge, and like some of the stuff that James, and you speak to James, he's over here. I'm not sure if Mike's here. Mike's just introduced the first three low traffic neighbourhood schemes in Haringey. But one of the things that's been really useful, and it's the same thing I have with Liz as well, we've got an amazing network of people who do my job, basically, who we just support each other, both in terms of information sharing. When Mike was starting his journey to set up the low traffic neighbourhoods schemes in Haringey, me and Rowena, who's my counterpart in Islington, we were like, you know, offering our officer support to his officers. You know, like all of that sort of stuff is happening, which is amazing London-wide. And I think none of us would be successful in what we're doing if it wasn't for all of us working together. And there's an amazing network of that, and it comes under the umbrella of the London Council's Transport and Environment Committee, which my mayor Phil chairs. But you know, like I should just say, like, you know, I know we're talking a lot about Hackney because of the logo being here, but you know, like, some of what I mean, like what James is doing in North Woolwich Road, which obviously Will was talking about earlier, I mean, that's pretty transformational stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's because as you were talking, this is something that I was thinking about. This kind of, we know that the support, public support for the for this these kind of measures for more cycling and walking, people want to see it. But then there's that moment where it's being proposed and people realise, oh, this is going to affect me, and there is that kind of outcry. And there's the element of having that discussion beforehand with people. And I think this is something that Newham's my council. James Astor and his team put in low traffic neighbourhoods in my area during the pandemic. And it's transformed the local neighbourhood for me, so I've been able to see the impact of that, and you see children out on the roads and you would never have seen before. But you know, there is that kind of backlash, but it's I think one thing that they did well was kind of tweaking the plans and making people feel that they were listened to. This is my observation as a resident and speaking to your council officers about it, and that seemed to help a little bit. I mean, and yeah, this kind of peer-to-peer support, because there is this fantastic stuff happening around the country, and I think it is hard on councillors, and there has been personal attacks as a female journalist out in the world on social media. You know, being subject to this kind of abuse online is actually it takes a toll, I think, and having seen a tiny bit of it myself, it makes you realise actually that this is not easy stuff to do, and if you're a councillor, maybe it feels like it's not worth it if you feel like you're on your own out there, and there kind of needs to be that support, a bit of a love in here, virtual hug everyone. But yeah, Liz.
Yes, I think that is really important. So alongside me, the support that I'm getting from Meta, I'm also part of a network of transport leads from the English core cities and Welsh core cities. So that's all the big cities outside London. And we meet regularly on Teams, and it's more like a therapy session. But we're all encountering the same issues. But I think we have to really, you know, push, you know, the power of imagination. We need to help people understand what it can be like to live in a place that is not blighted by traffic. And I think, you know, people can remember back to the first lockdown, you know, when actually you could walk on the street and hear birds, and you could see what your neighbourhood was like without traffic. And then for Birmingham, we've had other experiences during the Commonwealth Games. Much more of the city centre was pedestrianised than is currently the case. So that's given us, you know, a target to reach there. We also had a very strict transport policy where we said there will be no parking at the Commonwealth Games venues, and we had shuttle buses. You know, we provided transport, you know, with the tickets to the events. You know, so that again is, you know, that if people can see what modern bus travel is like, then they're much more likely to adopt it. You know, because public transport is a really key part of this picture for me. But I think the mutual support is really, really important, because I know a lot of women councillors who have been subjected to some quite vile and quite alarming abuse. You know, so it's, you know, you have to be quite fearless to pursue this, but it's worth pursuing it because it is so transformational.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something. Something that perhaps the last sort of question before we ask everyone to chip in, is just the sort of pace of change. I mean, we have this urgency. We've seen in Canada this week the fires, the smoke that's kind of spreading across America now, and it's terrifying. It's like this apocalyptic vision of the future, and we know that transport has an enormous role to play, and yet, you know, everything takes so long. I mean, I take my hat off to anyone who works in a local authority, because I can see that it's just very, very slow, and I know that in Birmingham, you know, it's just it is one of the places where I'm not sort of singling you out, but you know, things just seem to take so long. There's the A38 cycle route that's not going to happen until 2027, but the money's there, but it just seems like this capacity
issue. Can I just clarify?
And,
we have a very long segregated cycle route on the A38 from the city centre to Selly Oak, near where I represent, and what we've got now is money from the City Regional Sustainable Transport Settlement to extend it to Longbridge. We had a pop-up cycle lane, which I'd say I fought to keep.
It got removed.
And it got removed because there was a backlash against it. So, I mean, that is the reality of dealing with this stuff, because you know, the Conservative MP in Northfield was able to whip up 3,000 people to say that they wanted it removed, whereas I managed, you know, a measly 600 or 700 on my petition. So I think it's a constant battle. But we're moving forward with those plans, but we've got all of the issues, you know, about the capacity and the skills that are out there in the market, you know, to give us commissioning technical advice and design advice and so on. But, you know, but we clearly need to move, you know, forward with that. And Phil and Adam Tranter, again, who's much missed in this discussion, is helping us with some capacity support.
Yeah. So, I mean, with this kind of context, this sense of urgency and the difference between the urgency and the kind of pace of change, what, how can we be sort of more radical? I think this is something that Adam and I were keen to talk about when we discussed this issue. Like, how can we be bold and get things moving more quickly?
I think we have to address car restraint. We have to address car restraint. You know, it's not enough just to provide carrots. We have to be prepared to make driving a little less attractive. That's what's so great about low traffic neighbourhoods. You know, with a very, very small amount of capital investment, a bollard, a planter, you know, obviously it's great to do the placemaking, but they are really cheap as chips in construction terms. If you do the consultation and engagement, then that's where you put all your money. But the great thing about that kind of approach, that traffic, it's just traffic management, different types of traffic, at the same time as making driving a little more difficult, you make walking and cycling a little easier and more attractive. And that's what we have to do, that's what we have to do citywide, I think.
The little plastic wands?
Anything. No, I'm thinking, I'm actually talking about whether it's charging, whether it's the Birmingham cells. Sorry, that's not a great name, is it?
The cells makes it sound like a prison. The circulation.
Yeah, given the Oxford, the Oxford empties
were.
Segments. Yeah.
Like the
Oxford empties were saying
we're
going to be 15-minute neighbourhoods meant we were going to be locked in our neighbourhoods. No, it's not that. The Birmingham cells. But yeah, you know, the Ghent style, that's really ambitious. We've been doing similar work for the town of Shrewsbury. You know, we've amazingly got. A conservative controlled unitary county authority pretty much signed up, heard it here first, to sign up to Ghent style traffic cells in the centre.
Segments.
So in Shrewsbury, and the reason that we've been able to, is because they've been talking about this for 5 years and it's taken a long time to get there. So, but that's what we have to do, you know, we have to be prepared to bite the bullet and make driving a little less convenient.
I think that's where it comes back to the political leadership, though, because I've had a lot of support, you know, from campaigners, my officers like Mel, and experts like Adam and Phil, so that I can now articulate, you know, I think quite clearly, you know, that we are trying to make, you know, driving less direct and less convenient, because that's the nudge, that's the, you know, the prompt, the mode shift out of your car. Because in Birmingham, there are 250,000 journeys by car of less than a mile every workday.
Oh my word!
You know, so I mean, it's at the scale of what we're trying to tackle is absolutely massive. And you know, obviously, you know, we're a relatively young city, so there's some people who are essential drivers or have got mobility problems who may need to drive, but the mass of the population can walk or cycle if they learn to cycle. But there's other. I just wanted to say there's public health benefits as well, because we have other big challenges in Birmingham, like poverty, deprivation, the diseases of poverty and deprivation, obesity, diabetes, all of those things, which actually getting out, walking and cycling is good for your mental health and it's good for your physical health. So I think, you know, we have to be upfront about that. And again, people who've heard me speak before will know that each time I get up, I will always say, you know, we need fewer cars. And I think that's, you know, that I am one of the few politicians in Birmingham who's prepared to get up and say that now. There's more of us now. But that's where we need, you know, to mentor our own colleagues in councils, because that's really what we're about. Because, you know, we've had a number of really terrible fatalities of cyclists in Birmingham over the last couple of weeks, and a child was killed. Obviously, I can't comment on the causes, but what I know is that you can, you know, if you have, you know, high levels of traffic on the road,
2 weeks in Birmingham.
If you have high levels of traffic on the road, then you will have a problem with road safety, and we need to do all the things and, you know, build the infrastructure. Rigorously enforce the rules of the road, work with the police, work in partnership, but in the end it's de-trafficking that's the key. And I think that's the real difficult thing to grasp the net on if you're a politician. And in Birmingham, we've got, you know, we need to talk to the MPs, we need to get everybody on side, because that's the agenda.
Mette, how can we be more bold in London? Well, I feel like we have focused on Hackney, you're right, and other places in London are doing great things. The City of London, we're near Bank Junction, which, was it how many years ago? I think it was a couple, not that long ago, they kind of closed that 7 till 7 to 3 traffic. So
I mean, there's a number of things, right? So I don't think there's one answer. I feel like there's a package of things that you can do to be more bold. I also think sometimes we have to look back and celebrate at what we've been doing. So, for example, like, we haven't really spoke about school streets too much in this conversation, but with our school streets, we've got 49 in Hackney, and we've done some, the data might be slightly out of date, but at the time when we done the data, we surveyed kids before they went to, before they we implemented the schemes, and then after the schemes went in, and some of the impact had been quite transformational. So I think 31% more children had been walking to school since we brought that scheme, those schemes in, and then over about 50% of children had more had been cycling or scooting to school, and that's like significant behavioural change. And on top of that, tailpipe emissions on average was down by about 74% in those schools where we surveyed. So clearly, like, there are quite radical and transformative change, and I think, you know, everything that we're doing from our low traffic neighbourhood schemes. I mean, we brought in 20 miles per hour, one of the first boroughs to bring it in, the car free development and stuff. I think, you know, what Liz spoke about, the alternatives, I think is really important. We obviously, I know we've got Lime Bike represented here today as well, but we obviously rolled out the dockless bikes in a borough in the summer of last year. And I think we now average about 100K trips per month, which is like unreal. But then we also have to have, you know, like bus priority, the stuff that I spoke about earlier in my opening remarks. So I think there's all those things. And, you know, like, as I said, I think the next step is road user charging. And that's a step that we need to sort of to move towards, because ultimately all these little things that we're talking about now is sort of tinkering around the edges. Like, you know, in order to really drive down traffic, you're going to have to move towards, you know, there are some parts of Hackney, for example, when I can think about now, it's like, that's it. Like, there's no more next step. The next step is basically road user charging, you know. You can build out, I don't know, remove some parking spaces, do this and that, but it ain't going to make a huge difference. If you're talking drastically about reducing traffic, there are certain pinch points of the borough where you're going to have to start to think about road user charging. But it comes back to that point about the political leadership, which Liz spoke about. And, you know, my plea to everyone in this room is, like, look, you've really got to, if you're a campaigner, like, we need you. We need your support. And, you know, like, don't just campaign at the time of, you know, pushing us to do schemes. But also, when we do push those schemes, actually go out and celebrate it. I'll give you an example, and I'm not even afraid to sort of, like, single out this group. William Patton Primary School. I was actually speaking about this earlier. I've been a councillor for 9 years in Stoke Newington. They spent the most part of my life, my whole time as a councillor, campaigning to have action taken on Church Street. I became a cabinet member in March 2021. I met with them 2-3 times within the space of 3 months, and they were saying all sorts of things to me. Oh, you know, you're letting us down. You're never going to bring in the scheme, etc., etc. Brought the scheme in, right? Bearing in mind they've been campaigning for it for 4 or 5 years, and then they didn't say nothing about it publicly. And then when I asked them about it, they said it's because it's going to make that scheme is now going to make it worse for other schools like Princess May on the High Street. So I said to them, didn't you know that when you were asking for it 2-3 years ago? But that's the sort of point I'm trying to make. So obviously it's about challenging us, but if you're going to push politicians to take action, and then when they take action, you're going to basically come out and criticise them, that's not going to give the confidence to be bold. So you've got to celebrate the wins as well. Otherwise, it's going to be difficult for politicians to move forward.
Good point. We have 5 minutes left, I've been told. I thought we had longer because we started slightly late, but apparently we don't. So apologies, Liz, quickly.
I just wanted to say, in the spirit of celebrating things, I'd like to invite you the next time you're in Birmingham to come and cycle the Northbrook Street segregated cycle lane, because that's something that I went and visited on Saturday, which was World Bike Day at the beginning of Bike Week. And I think the other thing on politicians, I think you ought to challenge your councillors wherever you do they walk, do they cycle. I'm not saying they have to do that for every journey, but it would be good if they did it occasionally and took pictures of themselves cycling or walking or travelling on the bus, because I think that's a test of whether people are actually, you know, get the agenda.
And I was just going to say, talking about road pricing, again, Lee Waters can't be here in person, but look to Wales. Welsh Government has published a national transport strategy in support of a Wales-wide road user charging. Cardiff Council looking at road user charging, so it is happening around the country. So let's look for it. Let's celebrate. Cambridge also. So it's coming. It's coming.
Yeah. I have bad news for you. I've been a bad chair. We've been told we have to wrap up. But thank you for being here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.